This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Enterprise Biz Bytes with me, Rich Bradbury. And joining me in the studio on this Tech Thursday installment of Biz Bytes is our resident tech meister, Jeff Sandu.
Thank you.
Now, we've got a lot of stories, good stories to cover today, including one dissection of Amazon's AWS Masterclass that you yourself attended.
Definitely.
We're also going to talk about how the Samsung Galaxy S8 iris scanner, already been fooled by a group of hackers. And I say hackers in those air quotes because it's not really a hack. But first, let's kick things off then with this summary of sorts on Google's next marketing 2017 event.
Exactly. So, Richard, imagine, think you're a marketer, and you know what would be like your first headache or problem when you know you're moving into the digital world to do marketing?
I need to make sure that I'm targeting the right people, I'd imagine.
And also, well, you know, if you're a marketer, finding campaigns, whether your campaigns are working out or not, is probably also one of the causes of the headache, right? Wondering, is this actually working?
Am I spending my money effectively?
Exactly, right? So, Google has come out with some new, simple, and yes, they are free for marketers tools to market their business. As a marketer, you would want to create as much interactions with your customers as much as possible to increase your brand exposure. So you'd have various marketing tools like image, video, search, social, and then the business website, and then the apps that you're creating as well to enrich your customers' journey to purchase a product or service. So tracking all of them is a pain.
Right. Yeah. Carry on.
Yeah. So on top of that, you know, we're sort of like switching between devices to make it harder for marketers to track us, which it's, you know, we're sneaky, right? Like we like to switch from, you know, Facebook to Instagram, and then we probably even switch a device, a component from Android to iOS.
You switch devices every week.
Every week, exactly. So Baba Pahlavan, he's the senior director of product management at Google. He said there are four faults with attribution tools today. Number one is difficult to set up because sometimes it takes months or even years to set one up. And then there's the very complex model into it. You know, experts are required to set up custom models. And then you lose track of customers when, you know, your customers switch devices. You lose track of all of them. And then obviously what the last one is they aren't integrated with marketing and advertising tools. So, you know, business owners don't actually know how to use it to optimize their campaigns.
Right. So Google, God, as you say, is obviously using machine learning, right? Or AI or something to help with marketeers with their advertisements. Three new innovations were announced then recently. The first is this thing called Google Attribution, which helps to answer the big question, is my marketing working?
Yeah, so the way this works is that you connect your Google accounts and then you import your data and you choose the attribution model you want and also you see the result that works best. Then you can export the model to whichever Google account that you like and optimize the campaigns using this attribution model that you set. Sometimes it may take you months and months to do something like this, but with this Google attribution tool, you could be done within a few minutes.
So it's cross-device, cross-channel, integrated in its use, actionable, and free.
That's what Malaysians love.
Of course. So what's also interesting then is that this product is based on a rebuild of Adometry, which was an analytics company Google acquired 3 years ago.
Yeah, so they went silent about 3 years ago and now it's bang, it's out. Obviously with Google branding, but you know, it's obviously from the guys who made Adometry. Now the second announcement was consumers can now find physical stores via YouTube video ads using location extension. Yeah, so I see you're confused.
That's like, clever, though.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, we rely heavily on our mobile devices to sort of like, you know, research or, you know, get to our destination or buy, you know, buy headphones, for example, like, you know, the ones that you're using. And we will go online and we search for it. But do we actually know the store, you know, which is the nearest store that actually has this, you know, this headphones that I'm looking for? Right. So that's what YouTube now enables you to do it. So, you know, it's marketers are now using, you know, innovations like promoted places and local inventory ads to showcase special offers and what's in stock at nearby stores. So, you know, what would you do if, you know, if you wanted to purchase a product, say earphones, you would go online?
I do. I mean, I go online. I kind of do my research within my budget.
Yeah.
And then I'm really bad at doing this, though, right? Because what I'll do is I'll know roughly what I want, and I know that some of the stores don't stock what I want. But I head there anyway in the vain hope that maybe there'll be something that I like. And I get in there, and I look at the price, and I'll quickly Google review of this headphone, you know, and I'll stand there in the store whilst the guy is going, "Can I help you, sir?" And I'm like, "Hang on, let me watch this 6-minute video, and I'll tell you in a minute."
So that's apparently more than what 50% of consumers do. They actually look for videos.
So I'm not alone.
You're not alone. I do it all the time as well. I don't need a sales assistant coming up to me, excuse me, sir, can you help? Do you want any help?
They follow you around like you have the plague or something.
I know. I don't need any help. I got my phone. Yeah. So like we look for videos relating to a product before making a purchase. So the second announcement of the location extension enables consumers online to find what they want from a physical store through a video. According to Jerry Dischler, he's the Vice President of Product Management for AdWords in Google. They can now help consumers who are online to find something in the physical world through a number of formats that work across search and maps that are designed to show what's in stores, and then it will drive people to the stores.
So the only thing I can see from this then is that you have to be signed into your Google account and your YouTube account for any of this to work.
Definitely.
All right, okay. So store visits and measurement will be available for YouTube TrueView campaigns, and currently available in 17 markets. Malaysia isn't one of them. But soon, apparently. And finally, the last announcement might be something marketers have been searching for to close the loop from ad click to purchase. The holy grail for online marketeers is closing the loop from ad click all the way through to a purchase.
Yeah, so what's the main problem with today's solution? It's they're cumbersome and they're complicated. So what do advertisers do currently? They integrate with a third-party software, which is a very tedious process to set up, and then it takes several months to even execute the project.
Yeah.
So Google just simplify things. First is the store sales solution. You'll now be able to measure the store's impact of an online advertising automatically without the need for an integration. So everything is a lot more simplified, and all relevant advertisers' information just appears on your AdWords account directly, just like an actual store visits or online conversations. Again, this is only for the US at the moment.
Okay. The second innovation then. The store visit solution. This is where customers who desire more detail and granularity, allowing you to go all the way down to the item or product category level by directly linking an advertiser's loyalty card, great idea, to Google Ad Clicks. With the utilization of importing digital data onto Google Ad Clicks, marketers get to measure store sales with simplicity.
Yeah, so if you're wondering how all this works and are these products privacy insured, Jerry explains that there are two solutions, the store business solution and the store sales solution, and the business solution is available in 19 countries, whereas the sales solution is only available here in the US.
Right, here in the US? You mean there in the US?
Well, sorry, there in the US.
You're over there in your wrong corner.
Yeah, I'm still there.
Yeah. Right, so here's how it works. A large number of users choose to share their location history with Google via GPS coordinates and a number of other signals. Google also has hundreds of millions of buildings rendered for the 3D Google Maps product, so they know the exact coordinates of these spaces, as well as other processes to understand how Wi-Fi and radio networks work inside malls and store spaces. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, they also have 5 million human radars that are manually asked for location information. This gives them about 99% precision when it comes to tracking a store visit.
Yeah, so coming back to privacy, Jerry ensures that these products, just like all of their other solutions, are privacy safe. So no personal info or ad click info is used for advertisers, only aggregated and anonymized figures are reported.
Right. Yeah. So some insights then from the early test results. Consumers who click a search ad before visiting a store are 25% more likely to make a purchase in the store and spend over 10% more in that store.
That's me.
Also, those who click on Google Ads drive over 40% more value in store than the average consumer walking through that door.
Yeah, and they also had a beta program, Virgin, with Virgin Holidays, and they generated twice the profit when they considered their store sales data in addition to their online sales data. Jerry also touched on improvements in machine learning and deep neural networks that can look at much larger data sets. This new model takes hundreds of signals like Wi-Fi strength, the Bluetooth beacon info, and the visit duration, and also determine which signals are most predictive of store visits.
Right.
This means that, you know, dense cities like Tokyo, for example, where business locations are small and very close together, it still allows Google to say with that, you know, 99% confidence that a store visit has occurred.
Right. Okay. So you might probably be wondering, what happens when somebody just walks through a door or into a store? How would you know if that's considered a store visit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, machine learning can also teach itself to avoid overcounting. Like when a user walks through a store to get to a parking lot, or when an employee goes to the store to work for a day, they can eliminate those numbers and give only true visit numbers from customers. All this enables better local ad experiences across the world.
Mm.
Right, so if you're a marketeer, this all must be really cool news for you. And if only these were instantly available here in Malaysia.
Yeah.
And also if only the retailers would be daring and adventurous as their fellow counterparts in the US and UK.
Mm.
I think we need to give them a push to boost
innovation. We need to shop more, probably.
Right. We have to take a very short break. We're going to be heading into some messages and some songs. We should quickly introduce DJ Arvin. He's here on the deck with us today. We're going with Arvin for now because we haven't found a cool name for him yet. If you have any suggestions, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Definitely.
We'll be right back after these messages. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Best for marketing. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes with me, Rich Bradbury, and Jeff Sandu. In the studio, on the decks, of course, is DJ Arvin for now.
Now, so tweet us at BFM Radio if you have a different name for Arvin.
We've got to find him a cooler name. He can't be DJ Arvin.
DJ Arvin for now.
Right, for now. With a four, of course.
The four, yeah.
Right, so, Jeff, the other day, you went off to...
I disappeared.
AWS AI Masterclass.
Mm, Amazon Web Services. So had an AI masterclass for media and bloggers who are interested in AI.
Right.
Obviously, I raised my hands via email.
Right.
And I RSVP'd myself shamelessly going for AWS AI masterclass.
What did you learn there?
No programming languages needed for this masterclass. So that's why I was like, ooh, this sounds interesting. So basically, the first thing you learn is you just learn about the offerings that AWS has. So just to give you a bit of a background of how big AWS is. They're now in 16 regions, 42 availability zones with 76 edge locations, and this is to accelerate the end connectivity to users, so all the way down to your smartphone, accessing AWS cloud, right?
Right.
And even BFM here, actually, our BFM.my, we're actually, you know, hosting on Amazon
AWS.
We are.
AWS. Our podcasts are hosted right up there.
Yeah. So they obviously offer services, applications, desktop app streaming, platform services, code service, security infrastructure. And, you know, these days, all of these are actually combined to either as an API or an SDK, right? And we all run building some app, which is an API, or we build some solution, some SDK solution. And cloud model works well for this because you pay for what you use.
Right.
And it doesn't have like a limited capacity. It's unlimited, basically. You can turn it off anytime that you want in case, you know, you feel like, oh, you know what, for this next month, I'm not going to run my business, I want to shut down for a while.
Maybe I'm trying to save on my data cap or something like that.
You can do that as well. And the best thing about cloud, especially for AWS, they've dropped prices 61 times since 2006.
Wow.
Yeah. So the price... Previously, it was very expensive to go into cloud. You know, in 2009, 2010, when I first started talking about cloud, it was really expensive.
Mm.
Now, though, every single startup is running a cloud because it's cheap and, you know, you don't need to hire manpower to run a cloud services, right? So they showcase how you can connect different devices to talk to each other using AWS.
How does that work then? Right?
Yeah, so think of this is like machine talking to another machine, but you're...
So dots and dashes, ones and zeros.
You would think so, right? So back then, we would have to communicate with them using their language, which is the 101010 whatever.
Right, okay,
We're talking like C3PO now, right? Or R2D2, right? So nowadays... we don't have to do that because machines understand natural language. And that's where AI comes into play.
Siri does not understand my natural language.
Well, that's because you don't speak English, Rich.
Oh, snap.
I'm just kidding. However, well, Siri, you know, there is a bit of a problem when it comes to, you know, voice-activated softwares like Siri. Google Now as well is still not perfect. Cortana is still not perfect. But what it does is there are a few products that are really good. Amazon Echo is one of them.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
Obviously, you know, the guy that was showing off, you know, how machines talk to other machines, he was using an Echo as the main device.
In Malaysia?
Yes. So you can't actually get the Echo here in Malaysia. And if you can actually buy it from the US, bring it here, but then you got to do, like, you know, crazy amount of hacks.
We won't
suggest doing it. Wait for it until it launches here. So Echo, you know, understands natural language. So what it was, there was a Sphero. It became famous because of BB-8.
I remember.
Yeah. So this was the standard Sphero ball that is Bluetooth connected to a Raspberry Pi that's connected to AWS. And the reason why it's needed a Raspberry Pi is because the Sphero doesn't have Wi-Fi that can be able to connect to the AWS server
itself.
So you got a Bluetooth connection to a Raspberry Pi. From there, it connects to AWS server.
And then, okay, now I'm seeing it. Yeah, got it.
And then the second highway is where your Amazon Echo connects to AWS server.
Okay.
So both of them now has the same destination.
Right.
So how do you power the Amazon Echo is you talk to Echo. And once Echo understands that, hey, in this same house, there is also a Raspberry Pi that's actually talking to a Sphero ball. So if you're, you know, asking Amazon Echo, like, Echo, could you turn the Sphero's ball from red to green color? And that's what Echo would do. Echo will know that, hey, in this system that I have, in this house that I have here, there is a device that's named Sphero, and I can actually change the color from red to green or blue to yellow and all this kind of stuff. So that's how it is, and it's just using voice itself.
Very cool.
And it also showed you how AI or artificial intelligence actually see the world.
That sounds a bit scary. How exactly does it see it? Because, you know, in my head, in the future, I'm seeing images of, like, Predator and, and kind of, you know, heat signatures or maybe lines, digital lines. It's not like that at all, is it, Jeff?
No, not like that at all. Well, not that scary, but I think in the future, maybe if someone were, you know, someone evil may want to do it, I think that's, you know, they will model it after Predators and, aliens versus Predators and all that, right? But right now, it's all cutesy, you know, it's Sphero balls, it's Amazon Echo. How AI actually sees is true image recognition, and you got to train the AI to understand what these things are. So, you know, they showed off a clip of James Bond. I think it was Casino Royale. There was a scene in the beginning, you know, of the Aston Martin, and, you know, a lot of people were running around. So it showed a scene of what the AI sees, and it draws boxes around humans, and it labels them as humans, and then it draws boxes around cars, and it labels them cars, and suitcase, sunglasses, and all these kind of things. And how it knows is because you teach how a person would look like.
Right,
you know, a person
would
look like this. And you got to train them basically just like how you would train a child, for example. So previously, when we would talk about engineering or programming, we got to do the reverse thinking of it. Like, how do you want to achieve this? And then you reverse engineer the thing. AI is a lot of like teaching a kid. You got to teach him how to, you know, see things, and what you got to tell him what is blue and why the color blue is this, and so on and so forth. This is a human. This is a bird. This is a plane. This is a sunglasses. Once you keep training it, it will understand, and then it will know, and it will identify more different variants of it.
I mean, we know that there are some AI out there that has been trained for a long time. You know, they know an awful lot of answers to a lot of these questions, you know.
Probably to life as well.
Probably have more answers than we do, in fact, you know.
Definitely, yeah.
Okay.
So the other example that it gives was, you know, the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah.
There are actually 43 quintillion unique combinations for the Rubik's Cube. So so how it happens, if you teach an AI to solve a Rubik's Cube, you actually have to teach every single step around the way.
Really?
So what happens is with the AI, that's like the basic AI. You got to teach everything, right? So right now, you just got to teach like maybe the first few steps from it, and then it understands how you get to your destination.
Right.
And then from there, you could then program it to start learning ways of how it could solve with that same destination, which is, you know, all six of the sides are the same.
If you have this color in that corner.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. So it starts learning all this kind of thing. It's very much like a brain. So in Amazon Amazon AWS server itself. We saw Amazon Polly. So this is the one where it turns text into a lifelike conversation. It's using intonations. It will try to render based on context. So if I'm ending my question with a question mark, and then it replies me in that same intonation as well. It doesn't just, you know, speak like a robot and I just give you a standard answer. It understands, you know, that, you know, we talk with, you know, tonality up and down.
Unless you're Australian, where everything shows up like that. Sorry, Australia. Not everybody, of
not
course.
Everybody, not everybody. Course, but... And then there's Amazon Lex, L-E-X. So this one turns conversational interfaces into your application and is powered by natural language understanding and also automated speech recognition model, which is Echo or Alexa. And then it will understand text and then you will build conversational tools for these AI. And then obviously Amazon Recognition. This is the one where you identify photos and, you know, three car person, and it detects facial expression as well, which is really cool because it will detect your face. Are you happy or are you smiling? Are you angry? It identifies faces and, you know, it kind of loops them. Or, you know, Facebook faces, they have this thing where it identifies you are Richard and so forth. This is one step further. It identifies, these are the few pictures of Richard happy. And these are the few pictures Richard looks confused and all that. So, yeah.
I look confused all the time on most of my Facebook pages.
Scary, scary.
Right. Anyway, so you've learned all of that. And that's an awful lot to take in for, you know, but it is
two
a masterclass, I guess, right? What did you actually do? What did you build? What did you make? You know, I mean, you're going for an AI class.
Pinky,
you've got to have done something.
I'm just thinking of Pinky and the Brain. No, no. Well, I didn't build anything that could rule the world and so forth. But what we did was we had a training on building your own chatbot, your AI chatbot.
Oh.
And you know what? Without any programming, you know, background on my end, and you know, without having like a full day course, it was just a 20 minutes demo and a training of how to build this bot. I could build a bot that could answer three questions, like, you know, I want a coffee, and then it will reply me, what kind of coffee do you want? And then it'll ask me, then I'll say like mocha, and it'll ask me, do you want it hot or cold? And I'll be like, I want it hot, and then it will deliver my coffee. It will send a ping to a mock-up demo that we had. So if you're successful, it will ping the server itself. So within 15 minutes, with no programming language, just using AWS itself, I managed to build a chatbot. Very easy stuff. So I'm just thinking, like, if you're a developer, the amount of things you could do with this, like just for us, BFM, imagine a day when you go onto BFM Radio's Facebook page and you could just, you know, chat with BFM on our Facebook page and you go like, hey, is there any podcast that, you know, that's about 25 minutes long because Waze says it takes me 25 minutes to go home.
Right.
We will be able to sort of, you know, curate all this kind of information that, okay, you have a journey of about 25 minutes and based on your, you know, maybe your profile photo or if you upload a photo to us, we can see your kind of mood that you have, whether you're happy, angry, sad, and we could then suggest podcasts that will fit your mood and will, you know, fit your journey time as well. And this is something that it's already here, it's just a matter of us implementing it. And
I mean,
very
this,
cool
you
stuff,
know, to kind of continue that as well, you're in your car, obviously following Google Maps home, and by the time you've got home, Google Home, as it was, could have prepared you a cup of coffee, your lights are on, your favorite music is playing.
Oh man, the future.
Oh, I don't know if I'm excited. I am excited about it.
But also creepy because, you know, it's so many things we're sharing with our devices. And, you know, time and time again, they're not perfect, these devices. Like, my phone still hangs every now and then.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everyone does. Even your car. If your car is like a fully automated car, I am sure you've had problems with it because it's a fully automated car.
I mean, imagine if it kind of misinterprets that smile as one of those pretend smiles. So when you get home, there's happy music playing and you're like, this is the last thing I want to be listening to.
But it's the first step.
Moving on, when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about some iris scanners on the new Samsung Galaxy S8. Little break from Enterprise Biz Bytes with me and Jeff. We'll be right back after these messages. BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9.
You're back on Enterprise Biz Bytes with me, Rich, and Jeff. All right, so if you guys haven't figured it out yet, our boy over here, Jeff, is a bit of an Android fanboy. Right, Jeff?
Yes.
Just a little bit. He's actually got himself one of those swanky, shining Samsung Galaxy S8s.
An
S8 Plus.
Yes,
all right. Which, according to our next story, has already been tainted less than a month after it hit the shelves around the world. You may have read a bit about this. So according to this article by The Guardian, the iris recognition feature in Samsung's new S8 smartphone has been defeated by what they call German hackers, who call themselves the Chaos Computer Club.
Wow.
they never have these inventive names. A lot of Google, you know, a lot of hackers have really cool names, but this is like a chess club.
Exactly.
Anyway, apparently they're a long-running hacker collective formed in Berlin in 1981, way before you were born, Jeff. I was 5 years old at the time. Right, and they released a video showing the security feature on the S8 being fooled by a dummy eye into thinking that it's been unlocked by a legitimate owner.
It's not really a hack, though, right? Like, right. This is just, you know, people just trying to figure ways to get into a system. And, you know, this is not by any means fault of the phone or something like that. And later on, we'll sort of, you know, go down into the details of how they do it. And you realize, okay, this isn't something that, you know, I could just take a photo of Richard and then, you know, unlock your, your Samsung Galaxy S8 Plus and all that kind of thing, right? So it's just, you know, it's just a trick in a way. Come on, like, you know, don't bash the phone. It's just a small, tiny trick here.
All right, easy tiger.
Yeah, so anyways, coming back to these ingenious hackers, so how do they do this? Well, they made an artificial eye using just a printer and a contact lens to match the curvature of the eye. And they say that, you know, this is best created using pictures of the iris taken with a digital camera in night mode.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So they also warn that, you know, the security risk to the user from iris recognition is even bigger than with fingerprints, as we expose our irises a lot, said the group's spokesperson. If you value the data on your phone and possibly want to even use it for payment, using the traditional PIN protection is actually a safer approach than using body features for authentication.
You see,
but I'm a bit...
Well, no. I mean, I've always thought a very similar thing, right? Mm. The biometrics in general, if you are looking at biometrics in, for example, military compounds or whatever, we know they're very difficult, you know, and they're very... But on a consumer-grade phone, they're not particularly safe.
Yeah.
They're acceptable, and they're a cool little selling feature. Oh, scan your eye or scan your thumb or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this fella then goes on to warn that under some circumstances, a high-resolution picture from the internet is sufficient to capture an iris, but a Samsung spokesperson has said it would be impossible to use a normal picture of an iris, however high resolution it is, to fool the security feature.
Yeah, exactly. And the company did admit that the attack requires a rare combination of circumstances to pull off. It would require the unlikely situation of having possession of the high resolution image of the smartphone owner's iris. With IR camera, infrared camera. That's a really, like, you know, how often do you do this? Like,
right. Jeff, stand still. Let me scan your eye with my... You know.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Nothing. Just a memory of you that I
want
to have.
I want you in infrared.
And then you got to have a contact lens and a possession of their smartphone at the same time. And these hackers have conducted internal demonstrations under these circumstances. And they have actually found it extremely difficult to replicate such results.
Right. But it does... ship, this is the S8.
Yes.
It ships with a facial recognition feature, right?
Yep.
Again, which was defeated before the phone was even out on sale. And that can be tricked with something as simple as a printed out picture of the owner. As we know, the ill-fated Note 7 also had the same infrared iris scanner as the Galaxy S8.
Mm. It should be noted, though, that this group, these German hackers, the CCC, sounds like a chess club still, is the same group that first fooled Apple's Touch ID fingerprint sensor. There you go. Throwing back the ball at you. Yes. Yeah. So just a few weeks after the iPhone 5S hit the market, the hack was carried out by a graphite powder, a laser etching machine, a wood glue, all to trick Apple's system for ensuring that a real finger is being used.
Come on.
Hey, I bring these devices all the time, all right?
Yours needs a printout and a contact lens. Mine needs graphite powder and a laser etching machine.
It's all in my laptop bag, by the way, Rich. Right? I carry those things around, okay? It's a common thing that people carry around. So all of these require physical access to something the target had touched. Like a year later, or another hacker demonstrated a way to generate working fingerprints from high-resolution photos.
All right, then. So the CCC then add that this hack is on the S8 is a little bit simpler and could conceivably be pulled off with just a photo lifter from Facebook, a conventional laser printer, and a contact lens. By far, the most expensive part of this iris biometry hack was the purchase of the phone.
Yes.
The hackers said, ironically, they got the best results with laser printers made by Samsung.
Wow, interesting, though.
So all this... after it, in its marketing materials, Samsung claimed the patterns in your irises are unique to you and are virtually impossible to replicate, meaning iris authentication is one of the safest ways to keep your phone locked and the contents private. Jeff.
Mm. I actually use, you know, the iris scanner. I've had it set up, and also the facial recognition, because it's just easier. Facial recognition is the best one
just
for me.
Because as soon as
you lift your phone up, it unlocks the phone because it recognizes your face. So I like that. I haven't tried printing a photo of myself and see if it works. I will probably try it later on. I'll do it during the review of the phone that I will do very soon as well. But it's interesting to see, you know, the people are just finding many different ways to unlock your phone because your phone carries so much of data.
So much data.
And, obviously, you know, you're saying, like, these guys are saying with the S8 is simpler, but still, it's a lot of work to be in place. It's not something that, you know, you could just do it off easily. The Relevation also will add more fuel to the debate whether, you know, the use of biometric features as, you know, security passes, while, you know, biometric features can be more convenient, harder to steal or fake than passwords, well, they can come up with a one trade-off that, you know, you can't actually change them if, you know, your iris scanner or your fingerprint gets compromised.
All right. Okay, we're going to have to take a very short break so that Jeff can calm down a little bit. When we come back, we've got a story on two of Jeff's favorite pastimes, Instagram and Snapchat.
It's just one of them.
It's one of those days, right? Yeah. All right, you're listening to Enterprise Biz Bytes here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Blues, folk, metal. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes with me, Rich Bradbury, and Jeff Sandu. Arvin on the decks over here. moving on to all things Insta-E and Snappy, we're going to be quickly talking about some of your favorite photo and camera apps. First up, Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
So since introducing a stories feature last year, of course copying it from another well-known thing, mm-hmm. Instagram has added a boatload of new features to its stories. Most recently, it's Snapchat.
Snapchat, wow.
Like face filters last week. Mm. Now it's making it easier for you to find stories.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, Instagram announced that it has added two new ways to search for stories, bubbling them up on top of the Explore tab based on locations or hashtags. Mm. So if you've updated Instagram to the latest version, you'll start seeing location and hashtag stories on top of your feed. For example, when I open mine, I currently see Petalingjaya next to, you know, top live story ring at the top of the Explore tab. It's got a little, like, you know, location pin to indicate it contains stories based on this location.
Also a little bit creepy.
Yes.
Location-based story rings also show up when you search for a location, obviously, but they don't show up for all locations. If you want your stories to show in the location stories so that others can see, be sure to use a location tag in your story.
Yeah, you'll also start seeing story rings for your hashtags, but you'll need to search for those. For some hashtag searches on the Explore tab, you'll see the story rings on the top of your results of stories that uses that hashtag. Like story locations, be sure to hashtag your stories if you want them to appear on other people's profile. If you add a location or hashtag sticker to a story, then your story may be included in Instagram's larger story collections based on the stickers you use. Your stories will be shared only if your account is set to public, and that is if you know you've not sort of like toggled the private account mode in the settings on.
Okay, okay. And for those public accounts, you can still remove a story from a larger story collection after the fact. To do so, open your story and swipe up to see that viewer list for it. If your story has been shared in a larger collection, a location, or hashtag-based story collection, then you'll see it listed at the top of the viewer list, along with how many people saw it as part of the larger story. To remove that from the collection, just tap that X up there, and you know it'll hide it. Mm. Remember, if you don't want it to be seen, just check the options. Make sure you're not sharing stuff you don't want to be sharing.
Mm.
So,
now,
Snapchat.
Moving on to Snapchat. I'm not a big fan of Snapchat, and I know, Richard, you're not really
a big
fan of Snapchat
either.
And there are a lot of people here in Malaysia who are also kind of half-half, you know.
Yeah.
There are some who are big fans of Snapchat because
on
of
it all the time, man.
Crazy filters and so forth. And there are some who's go like, I just don't like Snapchat.
I mean, I know a previous co-host that springs to mind who's on it all the time.
Now, as you know, Instagram has been the home for influencers, at least here in Malaysia, and they're strong with that. And, you know, however, Snapchat, not so much. The idea was kind of floated around for a price tag of around £50,000.
Yeah. If you wanted to advertise.
That's a lot of money. Too.
It's a big chunk of change.
277,000 ringgit or something. As you can imagine, there weren't many takers.
Particularly here in Malaysia. The news that will make education and recruitment markets across the world rejoice, Snapchat advertising will soon be available without that wallet emptying, minimum spend, and with real-time optimization capabilities.
Yeah, so from June, Snapchat will be releasing advertising as a service which can be integrated as part of your digital campaigns to amplify video content and start conversations with your millennial audience. Yeah, Snapchat is the fastest-growing social media channel to reach the millennial audience. You just need to take a look at the stats to know that Snapchat advertising is going to be a huge deal. Take a look at taking a look at some of the stats from the UK, for example. Snapchat has over 7.1 million users in the UK. Around 30% of them are aged between 18 to 24 years old, and the average person spends about 2.5 hours of Snapchat per month.
That's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time of selfies.
But I mean, let's get it right. Snapchat is purely an image messaging application, whether you're already a member of the hashtag SnapFam, which means Snapchat family, of course, or never used it, it can't be ignored that Snapchat has undergone tremendous growth in video views, therefore becoming a valuable media contender for the media share of the wallet. I think we should probably move to our wrap-up now, Jeff.
Yes.
I think we've talked enough about
definitely,
that.
Definitely, yeah. So, you know, I think we need to sort of streamline everything. Early on, we started off talking about, you know, Google's, attribution tools for marketers. And then, obviously, you know, I rambled on about, you know, Amazon's AWS masterclass. I am now an AI expert.
An expert now, are we? What? Earlier on, you were saying how you didn't know anything.
Yeah.
You were saying that there's four faults with attribution tools, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, if you want to know more, I'm not going to repeat it. You got to download the podcast to, you know, listen on into what actually these four tools that marketers are facing at the problem and how God or Google has, you know, made it so much more easier for you.
All right. Speaking of seeing the world and whatever, Samsung's S8 security-driven iris scanner has already been defeated by a group of German hackers. Even before the phone went on sale, it can pretty much be tricked with something as simple as a printed out picture of the owner, maybe from a Facebook profile, and a pair of contact lenses.
iPhone users, you know, hey, these guys, they went after iPhone as well, not just Samsung.
All right. Okay. And lastly, we covered a boatload of new features on Instagram and Snapchat and looked at how they weigh against each other in this social media cold war that's heating up between Facebook and their rival Snapchat. If you missed any of these stories, feel free to stream the podcast again on the BFM app, available for iOS users on the Apple App Store and on Google Play for those on Android.
Coming up next is the Breakfast Grill replay. Paul Henry, the founder of Populous, was in the studio this morning. I won't give you so much of the details here, but it is a really fascinating interview about the industry's challenge and the future of the Stadia design for e-games. So that's coming up right after the 1 p.m. news.
And that's a wrap for this episode. For Android user Jeff Sandu and myself, Rich Bradbury, this has been Enterprise Biz Bytes, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.